Pizza Noir by Denver Day, Book 1, Chapter 4. We got off the elevator again, nodded to the receptionist, who was still in the throes of a cell phone convo, and we walked out into the day. "She smelled like bug spray, Ricky," Lieutenant Kenny said. He made a quick call to the captain, and then we headed directly back to Anders' apartment to talk to her newest cohabitant, Mr. Lewis Ho. Why he chose Chinese food rather than Italian-American as his preferred traffic vector may remain a mystery for all future ages. But did as he might. "But like I said, please understand, this is not the kind of investigation," Lieutenant McKinney repeated himself to Carrie's newest fiancée. "Anyway, were you at the after party with Miss Anders that night?"
"Yeah."
"When she got there, she was crying and told us about the bad scene at Squeezebox. She kept watching the door and asking what time it was. She kept talking about how Stevie should be there any minute. And she was upset. And I was there for her. I could sort of relate, because I knew Stevie. I used to work with him. Stevie's been dead less than 48 hours, and the two of you have gotten pretty heavily involved pretty quickly," I said. "She's a big girl detective, and she has a big appetite like that way. What you saw last night is the way we do things. And Stevie would have told you the same thing," he answered. "That's just how we roll." "I understand. I just thought I'd put the question. What about the person who did it? Seen him? Has anybody? Who is he?" "A Mexican. I think from down in the Bay Area, not a local. His face has only popped up every once in a while going back. I wouldn't know where to tell you to look. I don't know his name, but Carrie says he ripped off Stevie and fucked him and that girl on her date. Long and short, the lieutenant and I went to the diner next to the office for my lunch and his supper. The humidity had worked itself up into a squall. It was about 3 o'clock, so it was in between rushes. I ordered a BLT with brown mustard and iced tea. Lieutenant got the pesto spaghetti with a coffee chaser. Ricky, I don't know if I believe the large and conveniently murderous out-of-towner Mexican story, or if I believe in the tooth fairy either. He stirred the broccoli-based meal with his fork. But the man they paint as the bag man probably does live and breathe. Let me know what you find out. Basil braced, rather. A huge, glossy, fair-skinned brunette with a prominent, glistening, blood-red, harp-shaped tattoo on her stage right cleavage on top of a fresh coat of glossy black on top of many previous paint layers on top of the cinder block exterior of MC's alehouse. A good place to look for the man Alvarez, because of the transient intracoastal nature of its many two-wheeled regulars, even on a Sunday. And he wasn't hiding. Though sitting casually at the bar, he looked still, bowed up, and he dwarfed his bar stool and the Double Rocks glass in his hand. He was watching the sports news on one of the rafter-mounted TVs. It was pretty early yet, and it was pleasantly empty here, and still cool and roomy and not smoky. Barkeep asked if I'd like a drink, so I ordered a stout ale before I introduced myself. "You probably don't want to hear this, but a local stripper and her coked-up boyfriend say you killed 3 people early yesterday morning in front of a bunch of other people," and I handed him my card. He looked at it, took a few notes, and gave it back. "Well, as you're probably guessing, it wasn't me. You want to talk to my lawyer?" he answered. "It will not be necessary today," I answer. But it's my job to haul somebody in, ultimately, and so far, the best can I tell, it's probably going to be them. Why would they want to hang this on you? I asked. It was obvious to me that he was physically and mentally capable of doing what they said he did. But it was also clear that he was probably way, way, way too reasonable and intelligent and various other attributes of degree to grease three zites at a titty bar. He drained his glass. The barkeep picked it up, wordlessly adding ice. I'd say you've got a stripper and her boyfriend, ripping off her other boyfriend, blowing a jilted lover. In her office, at closing time. Ship change, no more, no less, he answered. And why paint me a red herring? I have a theory. I like to fuck hookers, and I used to fuck her all the time before she got all used up. Her boyfriend never liked it. Better than painting themselves, indeed. The barman set a new pour in front of him. Martin Alvarez. I gave him my card. Thank you, Mr. Alvarez. I appreciate your time. He waved. The gear, the good stuff, and the like that my suspects and their friends gird themselves into shit fucking lie and sometimes kill over comes up the California coast into the northwest from Mexico. Although the Great White North is a competing black market source, particularly for heroin, prescription drugs, and other blues. Because of the criminal codification of these imports, it's always been a hot black market, as the domestic market for these products is extremely and increasingly lucrative for their import, both from the north and the south of the border. Our database shows various logistics in our neck of the woods with respect to what groups are involved with and by approximate annual weight of traffic. The domestic motorcycle clubs have historical precedent herewith, but as the cartels from the south of the border have grown to Leviathan levels of power, scope, and influence in the decade before and the decade after the turn of the 21st century, their logistical operations are now much more competitive among the legacy domestic traffic along domestic routes. These political decisions are policed and regulated internally by the respective syndicates, since the states de facto are disenfranchised by their own laws from direct regulation of the black market. Steadily, as always, both production and demand continue their incline, and not just on the West Coast, but at that point in any way. Like, Alvarez was probably not my guy, regardless of what he did for a day job. Moreover, it seemed to me that this case was well downstream of any and all major narcotic syndicates, and where the pizzaman's coat came from was probably irrelevant. From here, I drove to the county coroner's office, Dixie Thompson, my ex-wife, and we get along much better now that we scotched that marriage. She said nobody had a claim the cadaver in the suit. He had no identification, no paperwork, except for a small wad containing about $900 in fifties and hundreds, a full pack of cigarettes, and a half dozen eight balls. He wore a very nice European suit with a tailor signature stitched in Cyrillic and gold thread. Picovici. The girl's family's been ringing the phone off the wall, and as for Mr. Wang, his people just said call him when we're ready to let him go. Of course, the suit doesn't have a date for the prom yet, she iterated, but they're all three packed up and ready to ship. Whenever you give us the word. You want to have another look, Rick? Yeah, roll him out. She handed me a yard work / bird flu mask and pulled the covers off the three bodies parked together side by side back in the back. The girl had changed out of her dancing gear and into cling fit jeans and a white belly shirt that read Naughty for Nice in a big screen printed pink letters. She had the requisite tattoos, butterflies on both ankles, an ivy tramp stamp on her lower back, a bangle on her right wrist, small barcode on the nape of her neck. She had long fingernails with blood-stained cocaine visible underneath her pinky nails. Stevie Wang's pinky nails were also manicured to deliver similar nose loads, but he had no tattoos on his olive skin. Dixie had put Wang's 1980s-style windbreaker back on him after the autopsy, but his and the girl's jewelry remained removed in metal bowls on one of the tables there. The suit still lay prone, all dressed up, with nowhere to go. He looked in his early 30s or so, with a shaved head. Unlike Mr. Wang, who was pretty skinny, this guy was fit and beefy and stout. Protein shakes for sure, if not anabolic steroids. He was also without tattoos, but his ballsack and dickhead had large gauge piercings, she said. And all three of them were pretty well totally shaved, she added. Save me a little time on the autopsy. Dixie, that's your department. I'll stick to worrying about who done it, told her, looking at her. She giggled. Anything else besides this guy's tackle that you found? No. There's a big palm-sized birthmark on the side of his torso, she said, not uncommon among Eastern Bloc honkies. Coffee? She asked. Sure, I answered.